Hello? Oh, there you go. Okay. Good. So this is class number 13, and we're going to talk about the Dreyfus Affair and Zionism, and they are related. So now Zionism, I'm going to talk about Zionism probably a little bit in the next three lessons, but it's not going to be a lesson on Zionism only. But because Zionism started in the late 1800 and kind of spans that all the way through to today, as we go through the rest of Jewish history and the history of anti-Semitism, you know, we can have Zionism parallel and events in Zionism that are going to be a parallel to that time, they're going to continue. So you'll hear about Zionism probably, like today, we could label today the birth of Zionism, and then maybe next week the growth of Zionism, and then the third week the establishment or the settling of Zionism, so to speak, if we want. But so you'll hear about Zionism and the Zionist quite a bit. In the next few classes, along with other events. The term Zionism, and we're starting with the notes here, the term Zionism and Zionists were coined in 1890 by Jewish activists by the name of Nathan Birnbaum, and who also played an important part in the first Zionist Congress of 1897. The Zionist Congress was eventually renamed the World Zionist Organization in 1960. So if you do some searches for your own research, the name changed in the 60s, alongside with its first president, Theodore Herzl. The word Zion comes from the Hebrew Tzion, a reference to Jerusalem, and often by extension to the land of Israel itself. And the first mention of Tzion in the Hebrew Bible is in 2 Samuel 5:7. If you wanted to look it up, that's the very first time you find the word Zion or Zion in the Bible. And again, in the Bible, it's interchangeably used for Jerusalem or the land of Israel. Mitchell Bard, who by the way is an incredible resource for Jewish things. He's not a believer that I know of, but he is the man behind the Jewish Virtual Library. I think I've given you some websites at the beginning of the class. The Jewish Virtual Library covers just about everything you want to know about Jewish people, Israel, Judaism, Holocaust, anti-Semitism. Tremendous resource if you ever look for something. If you go to the Jewish Virtual Library, a part of it is the myth and facts about the Middle East conflict, which is little blurbs about this is what they say, this is what it is, this is what they say, you know, myth and facts. And he's written a book, which he's revised because he's got more to put in, but he also publishes all those page by page on his website. You can just look at them and print them all for free, or just get the book if you want. That book alone is worth, and I think I paid $10 for it. It was incredible. So Mitchell Bard is a great scholar and an incredible contributor to the cause of Jewish people in Israel. And whatever he puts on his website as many sources, and I mean it's all backed up. Everything that he'll give you, there's a source for it. That's what I like about it, because a lot of people will say things and you go like, "Where'd you get that?" And they can't tell you. Mitchell, his book is well. If you Google his name, you'll get directly to his website, the Jewish Virtual Library, and on it there's a little button that will tell you about the myths and facts about the Middle East conflict. So he gives a definition of Zionism, like we did at the beginning of the class. I can give you a half a dozen definitions of anti-Semitism. We pick one. They all kind of like to say the same thing. It's a matter of which word you like best, but is it simple, clear? There's others by Ben Gurion, by Golda Meir, by Abba Eban, all kinds of people. He says the national Zionism is the national movement for the return of the Jewish people to their homeland and the resumption of Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel. Simple. You know, many others can be used. I like this one. It's simple and it's clear and concise. Okay, next is Point two, born out of necessity. European Jews, we're talking about Zionism now. European Jews had suffered at the hands of many popes, kings, and masses since the early church fathers. Anti-Semitism, from theological to social to ethnic, had punctuated Jewish life through the centuries, limiting, if not eliminating, any semblance of normalcy within the Jewish communities of Europe. The Crusades, we've talked about all those things. We're past all that, but in remembering all those things, the Crusades, the blood libel, the Spanish Inquisition, the first ghetto in Italy, and all the other subsequent ghettos later, to name a few, were ominous milestones on the timeline of Jewish history. It would eventually get much worse. And we've talked a little bit about the pogroms last week, didn't we? We did the pogroms last week. We talked about that, right? Yeah, okay. So it would get much worse with the pogroms and the Holocaust. The next few lessons really are going to be, a lot of it is going to be parallel because it's something, what happens in Eastern Europe, what happens in Western Europe, what happens in what was then Palestine, which is the land of Israel. So a lot of it is kind of parallel. So dates up to now, up to the 1800, we kept moving forward. Now we're kind of like going, it's like we're walking two or three different paths in the same on the same timeline. So we're going to go a little bit back and forth. So don't let that confuse you. So it would get worse later with the pogroms and the Holocaust. Yet something had to change now, as Jewish people felt that they had to leave the ghetto, not just physically, but spiritually and emotionally as well. In the midst of their misery, the Jewish people saw a ray of hope with the advent of the Haskalah. We talked about that as well last week. We talked about the Haskalah, the emancipation, the more freedom for the Jewish people. This came because of one powerful man in France. Remember who that is? Napoleon. Napoleon allowed the French Jews to be French in France and Jews at home. Italian Jews to be Italians in Italy and Jews at home. And he did that for just about every single country that he conquered for the French Empire. So the Haskalah is a Jewish version. It's the Jewish Enlightenment, and it was a movement among European Jews of the 17th and 18th centuries advocating a more secularized way of life, hopefully leading to their emancipation and thus better integration into a non-Jewish society. To an extent, it worked. I mean, you know, it was not a complete failure, but it didn't work as well for the Jews as it worked for the non-Jews. And the results of the Haskalah was a new emphasis on Jewish culture and history, much of it apart from religion. And I remember way back then, at the closing of the canon with the early church fathers, the issue between the church fathers and the masses that kind of followed because they didn't really know what to think for themselves and the Jewish community was a religious issue. You don't believe like we do. You killed Christ. We don't like you. And that's how it got started. It was really only a theological difference, but you know, there was not a lot of violence and physical damage of property and whatnot back in those days. But now, now you're going to find out that the Jewish people are going to split. They're going to be some very religious Jews and some secular Jews, and that's the beginning of the modern movement of the division between the Orthodox, the conservative, and the Reformed Jews. But it doesn't matter at this time in history. It's not going to matter anymore because it's no longer a religious issue. It's a racial. It's about to become a racial issue. We'll see with the coming of Hitler and the Nazi Party on the scene that they're going to go through a great length to measure the nose of Jewish people and the face and compare them to the Aryan race and so it's changing. Okay, the whole thing is changing. And it's going to change again because the new anti-Semitism today has morphed again, like this virus. You know, you keep trying to eradicate it, but it mutates into something different. It's the same at the core, but it mutates into something different that you think you had it and you don't, and you have to fight it from a different angle. That's anti-Semitism for you. So the results of the Haskalah was a new emphasis on Jewish culture and history, much of it apart from religion. It adapted to various Jewish communities across Western and Eastern Europe. For a short while, there seemed to be a period of respite for the Jewish people. Emancipation was working, so they thought. Okay, for a while, you had Jewish people that were accepted in society, that could get better jobs. They were not really a movement, but what we call salon Jews, people that we like that would be interacting with the nobility, and then Jewish people seemed to be more accepted, and it looked like there was there possibly could be hope for the Jewish people finally, since Napoleon, remember, friend and foe, Napoleon was not the nicest person with the Jewish people, but at the same time, the nice things that he did and the rest that he did, it catapulted the Jewish people into a new level in society when they had more freedom and more emancipation. So he was... there was some positive contribution, even if the motives behind the contributions were not all positive. Some of them were maybe negative. Napoleon made a big change for their freedom and their emancipation. Yet, we're almost at the turn of the century, and this poor Jewish man, and there are several movies made on him, this poor Jewish man is about to live 12 years of terrible agony. Now, most of you have heard of the Dreyfus Affair. That's something that you have maybe addressed in passing, but we're going to talk about it a little bit here. The Dreyfus Affair, it started in 1894, and you can put next to the title right there, Dreyfus Affair, 1894-1906. I could have put that. I failed to do that. It was 12 years of agony for this man and his family, and really, the Dreyfus Affair split France in half. Not necessarily 50-50, but it split France in two camps, and it was almost writing the preamble to Nazi Germany. This is what really, when you look at the Dreyfus Affair, you see a dress rehearsal of what's going to happen 40 years later. So this is important to be aware of the Dreyfus Affair. In 1894, France, at the time when Jewish people thought they had emancipation, that emancipation had prevailed, Captain Alfred Dreyfus, a Jew from Alsace, which is on the east side of France, near the German border, was accused of treason against the French government. The French Revolution of 1789 and Napoleon had brought a hope of equality and integration into French society for French Jews, but anti-Semitism, as a temporarily inactive volcano of hatred, had just spewed its lava again. As the Dreyfus trial went on, mobs of angry Frenchmen were shouting death to the Jews on the streets of Paris. Dreyfus was the only Jewish officer in the French army. In that area, maybe not in the whole Jewish army, but in Paris, he was the only in that office. He was the only Jewish officer. A letter was found. They call it a Bordereau, which is like a little memorandum. Was found that implicated this person who wrote the letter. That apparently they were working with the German government. Okay, and they appeared to be a spy for the German government. The letter was initial D. That's enough for me. It's initial D. It's got to be Dreyfus, the Jew, right? So that's all they had. They accused him. They took his penmanship. They compared. He was accused. They took his grade. I mean, you see the picture on the right, on the bottom of the page, when he is stripped of rank in January of 1895, a year later. That's him on the left. It's a pretty good rendition. I don't know if it's a photograph or not. I think it's a drawing, but that's Alfred Dreyfus. He was sent to to Devil's Island, where they sent all the prisoners. He was accused, convicted, sent to prison, and then people got involved. Clemenceau, who is a First World War general. Marshall, actually, he was a marshal. He was a big leader in France. Got involved, reopened the case. He was brought back. He was tried a second time, accused and sent for 10 years, but pardoned immediately. It took 12 years. In the process of all that, they discovered that the papers were not written by him, that it was a setup, and they just wanted to get rid of the Jew. Now, if you turn the page, on the bottom of the page, there is a newspaper article. It's all in French, but it really doesn't matter because I don't think it's big enough for you to read it. But this is an interesting paper, and I just love this. It's almost like I wish I had even a facsimile of that page somewhere in my house in a frame, and I might do that one day. J'accuse means I accuse. Letter to the President of the Republic by Émile Zola. Any of you know who Émile Zola is? Émile Zola is a very famous French writer, a popular writer. I've read many of his books, beautiful stories. And it's the equivalent of, who was the president under Ernest Hemingway? I'm drawing a blank here. The president, Hemingway. Who was the American president when Hemingway was alive? When was he alive? Ernest Hemingway. I'm trying to look for a very famous, worthy writer. I don't want to use like Stephen King or who do we have today? Who's? Yeah. So, well, I mean, the point I'm trying to make is a famous writer, not that he's worthy of much, but Dan Brown, who wrote the Da Vinci Codes and all those books, he's a multimillionaire, he wrote millions of books. You wouldn't get him to send a letter to George Bush or this was the front page of the equivalent of the New York Times. And so this is not exactly a private, can we meet? I need to talk to you. He published this letter. I read this thing. It's right on, but it's very gutsy. Émile Zola was actually accused, and he says at the end, I don't care if I'm accused of anything. I know I'm standing for the truth. He was accused of libel against the French government, and he was going to be imprisoned, and he escaped to go to England. And of course, he came back. Everything was fine when Dreyfus was exonerated. But he wrote this letter, and this precipitated the reopening of the inquiry. And I often think, when I think of what I do with anti-Semitism, when I talk in churches, when I speak in churches, when I talk to people, I often think, you know what? If I can be remembered as a modern day, not for my writing, but for the standing for the truth, a modern day equivalent of Émile Zola, when he knew it was right to speak all the way to the president, he said, you know what, you need to hear this. And it worked because they reopened the case, but it was not without a price. I pulled two quotes for you on, there's no page numbers on this one. Look at that. I forgot to put page numbers. Famous French writer Émile Zola wrote a letter to the French president Félix Faure. The letter was an accusation of all the wrongdoings and cover-ups that took place during the Dreyfus affair. His letter was published in the French newspaper L'Aurore under the title J'accuse, I accuse. Zola clearly sees the anti-Semitic agenda when he writes, these, sir, are the facts that explain how this miscarriage of justice came about. The evidence of Dreyfus's character, his affluence, the lack of motive, and his continued affirmation of innocence combine to show that he is a victim of the lurid imagination of Major Dupaty de Clam, the religious circles surrounding him, and the dirty Jew obsession that is the scourge of our time. And then later on in his letter, he writes, the best part of it is that Picard, another guy involved in the whole affair, was himself an anti-Semite. Yes, we have before us the ignoble spectacle of men who are sunken in debts and crimes being hailed as innocent, whereas the honor of a man whose life is spotless is being vilely attacked. A society that sinks to that level has fallen into decay. Those are just two sentences on a letter that is as long as a full page ad, and you see how small it is on the. It's a great article. He got in trouble until it was proven that what he was writing was the truth. Maybe a little blunt, maybe a little bold, and you don't talk to the president of the French Republic that way. But he felt like he could. Okay, he was back then a very famous writer. He uses notoriety to. And some of his money to do that, and it worked. And I think it's great. I think it's great. Okay, now, here's what's happening. The Dreyfus affair splits France in half. You've got the anti-Dreyfusard and the Dreyfusard. Those are the words for those who are with or against, the anti-Dreyfus or the Dreyfus proponents, whatever. And it splits France in half, anti-Semitic and those who want to go for justice and for the truth. This man is sent to cover the story. He's a there's a picture of him on the next page. The Vienna newspaper, Neue Freie Press, sent their Paris correspondent, Hungarian journalist Theodor Herzl, to follow the Dreyfus affair. And to be sure, Herzl's obsession with Jewish existence in a land of their own predated the Dreyfus affair. But it is the very treatment of Captain Dreyfus, and by association, the Jews of France, and frankly of Europe, that prompted Theodor Herzl to compile his work of several years into the historic pamphlet Der Judenstaat, or The Jewish State, published in Vienna in 1896. Before I read the quote to you, Herzl came to the to cover the story of the trial, and as a Jew, he was somewhat assimilated in German, in Austrian Jewish community, and in Austrian society, but still considered himself Jewish, rightfully so. And he's at the trial, and he's going like, he has an epiphany. He's looking at Dreyfus, and he's going, okay, emancipation is working to an extent, but not to the Jews. The Jewish people will never be free until they have a place they can call their own. This was the catalyst, the spark that gave birth to the Zionist movement. Now, this was not at that moment when he was in the courtroom that Herzl went, we got to find a land somewhere and move all the Jews back. He had already worked on it. He was looking at, you know, we have to get our people together from all over, and we have to have a country that we couldn't call our own. We're going to go back to he was pushing to go back to the Holy Land. It gets a little more complicated, of course, but this is something that was brewing inside. And when he goes to the Dreyfus trial, he realizes this Jewish man is innocent. And especially, you know, it gets confirmed as it goes further. The Jewish man is innocent. He's accused because he's a Jew, or dirty Jew, quote unquote. Our people will never be safe until they have a place. So that's the spark for the birth of the Zionist movement, the modern Zionist movement. In 1896, in his book, The Jewish State, this is what he says. Palestine, now I don't like to call it Palestine, but if we want to contextualize to when they were writing that, it's okay, so let's get over it, you guys. Because, you know, I personally cross out the word Palestine in the back of my Bible, and I put Israel, but, you know, that's on the maps, you know. But, let's get over that. Let's just read it the way it was written by the author. Let's not change the words. Palestine is our unforgettable historic homeland. Let me repeat once more my opening words. The Jews who will it shall achieve their state. We shall live at last as free men on our own soil and in our own homes, peacefully die. The world will be liberated by our freedom, enriched by our wealth, magnified by our greatness, and whatever we attempt there for our own benefit will redound mightily and beneficially to the good of all mankind. I don't believe in, you know, from a biblical standpoint, in modern-day prophets. I don't believe in, you know, the prophetic office, I believe, was closed at the end of the canon in the sense of getting new revelation from God. But this is as close as prophetic speaking as it comes to me. Because he actually said later on, and I don't know if I put it in the notes or not, but in 1897, he said that the modern state of Israel will be reborn within 50 years. And if you add 1897 plus 50, what do you get? 1947, which is when it was voted, and of course, so it's interesting. Again, I don't want to make more of this than we need to make, but it's just interesting. Herzl was convinced that the only viable solution was a mass exodus of the Jews of Europe back to Israel, the land of their ancestors, as he further stated. Political principle will provide the basis, technology the means, and the driving force will be the Jewish tragedy. And of course, when he said the Jewish tragedy, he's not talking about the Holocaust. Keep that in mind. When you hear the Jewish tragedy, you know, we're on this side of history. We go like, oh, the Holocaust, the 6 million Jews. He's not talking about the Holocaust. He's talking about up to, which was plenty. But it was, we had not seen the worst yet. Keep that in mind. Here's a little parenthesis that's a little biblical parenthesis. This, when you think about it for a second, but Zionism existed long before Theodor Herzl. We could argue that God himself was the original Zionist. You know, I like to say that, so, you know, and I don't think I invented the phrase, but I think I forgot where I heard it. As God is a Zionist. God is a Zionist. You know, when you think about it. So God himself was the original Zionist when in Genesis 12 he declared to Abraham that he would grant him and his descendants a land as an unconditional and eternal promise. The Abrahamic covenant can be seen as the foundation of Zionism established by the creator of the universe himself in Genesis 12, 1-7. If you look at it from this principle, Zionism cannot fail. You know, the reestablishment of the land of Israel was part of God's prophetic future. And it had to happen. Of course, the state of Israel is just one aspect of Zionism. They're related, but it's not it. Okay, Zionism is bigger than the recreation of the state of Israel, and the state of Israel is not just about, you know, not just because of Zionism. They're all kind of intertwined. But in Genesis 12, 1 through 7, we read, "Now the Lord said to Abraham, go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land which I will show you, and I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, and so you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." So Abram went forth as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. Now Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. And Abram took Sarai his wife and Lot his nephew and all their possession which they had accumulated and the persons which they had acquired in Haran. And they set out for the land of Canaan. Thus they came to the land of Canaan. And Abram passed through the land as far as the site of Shechem to the oak of Moreh. Now the Canaanite was then in the land. And the Lord appeared to Abram and said, "To your descendants I will give this land." So he built an altar there to the Lord who had appeared to him. So really, it's not Palestine. It's not really even Israel. It's the land of Canaan that God is giving to Abram. I mean, it's known today as Israel. But God is making a promise back there. He said, "This is going to be yours. I'm going to give it to you." There is a place in Scripture also, I think it's in Deuteronomy, where God says that actually it is his land. Don't get, you know, it's kind of almost tongue-in-cheek saying, "Don't be too cocky because really it's my land." He's saying this to the Jewish people. He owns the land. It's true. The Jewish people have the deed, but it's God's land. So we can argue... not the right word. We can say that God himself was the original Zionist from that perspective. But the modern Zionist movement was started by Theodor Herzl. If not the originator of the concept of Zionism, Herzl was definitely the visionary. That's on the bottom of this page here. We continue with the notes. The visionary, a catalyst, and the leader of political Zionism. Now, Zionism started as a political movement, okay? And then it kind of splits into cultural Zionism, and there's different kinds. It's all under Zionism, the desire for the Jewish people to move back to the land of Israel, to settle down, and to have a place of their own, and to flourish there and to be secure there, and so out of a political movement that was that would send key people to lobby all around Europe and parts of the Middle East for money and for power and connection with people to get Israel eventually to be the land for the Jewish people. It started from a political standpoint, but then it develops into something much bigger. So. He was the visionary, catalyst, and leader of political Zionism. Writer Ernst Powell in The Labyrinth of Exile, A Life of Theodor Herzl, explained, talking about Theodor Herzl, It's basically a biography of Herzl. He brought to it, talking about Zionism, what Herzl did to Zionism, he brought to it leadership, organization, and a unique blend of fantasy and practical realism. But his most important contribution by far was the messianic image of himself, his stature in the eyes of the Jews and in the eyes of the world. Of course, when we see the word messianic here, this is not the word messianic in a sense of the modern messianic movement of Jews who believe in Jesus. It's more of an image of leadership here, okay? So don't confuse that for a messianic in a sense of Jewish believer in Jesus. The word messianic means attached to the Messiah, from the Messiah. So it means a providential leadership. Of Herzl was seen as the Messiah, not the Messiah that the Jewish people expected, but a messianic figure. And when we say messianic figure, we don't mean messianic in the sense of a Jew believed that Jesus died for their sin. A messianic in the sense of a leader and savior and Messiah in a secular meaning, basically, not any. There you go. What, did I put a big M? No, I put a small M. I would never put a big M. Okay. So things keep moving. I mean, we're 1897 now. Now we're in Vienna. In Basel, Switzerland, east from Vienna. Now this is like a year after the beginning of the Dreyfus. So it's in the midst of the Dreyfus Affair. The Dreyfus Affair is not even finished, okay? 1894 to 1906, when he's completely exonerated, his rank is given back to him. He's got the apology of all of France, and you know, Dreyfus is back to normal, 12 years of agony, and probably never the same. But all this happens in the midst of the turmoil that's happening in France and how it's really dividing France. But the Dreyfus Affair, if the Dreyfus Affair in Paris was like a lake or a little puddle, and you would throw a rock in the middle of it, and that would be the Dreyfus Affair right there. It would just have those rings that go, when you throw a rock in the water, it goes much further than when you throw the rock. The ripple effect would go much further than Paris, France. It got much bigger. And again, like I told you earlier, it was the birth pangs of what would happen in Nazi Germany, 35 years later. So, Zionists get organized. Now, Zionists, the Jewish people did not all say like, "Oh, wow, this is such a great idea. We're going to militate and we're going to fight and we're going to for a land of our own." A lot of Jewish people were kind of settled in their way. The religious, there's still a lot of religious Jewish people, and they're going like, "You know what? We might not have the best life, but we like studying the Talmud. We like the synagogue life. We like the religious Jewish life. We're not looking for a secular Judaism going back to whatever, finding our own land. We're fine where we are." And there was still a belief. It puzzles me, but there was still a belief, I guess, deep inside the Jewish heart that we are part of the country where we are. German Jews, many German Jews stayed in Germany until it was too late, because they had fought in the First War. We'll see that in the next few lessons. They had fought in the First War as German soldiers, same with the French. They stayed in France. My own grandfather stayed in France. He fought the First War, and he thought that nothing would happen to him. Of course, things were different. So a lot of the Jewish people said, "You know what? We're not going anywhere." So there was the birth of Zionism. I don't want you to think that Zionism was all of a sudden, because we said that he was a messianic figure, Herzl, that all Jews rallied behind him and said, "Where do we go? I got my suitcase. I'm ready to go." This is not the way it happened. There was, there were disagreements. It didn't happen that easy. On top of that, of course, they were not able to just go. It's not like Herzl went to the leaders of the key countries and said, "Okay, we need a land. We're thinking maybe Palestine would work. Do you have a problem with that?" That's not the way it worked. That is not the way it worked. It was a lot more complicated than that. First, they had to... 1897, the Brits, don't they? Yeah. Yeah, the Brits own it. What? It's called Palestine, yes. Okay, so now what do they have to do? Well, if a movement is born, and you got to get organized. Okay, you got to get organized. So the picture on the page here is a picture of the first Zionist Congress. It's in Basel, Switzerland in 1897. And it was not without struggle that Herzl was able to organize this historic event, as most of the Jewish leaders of the time demonstrated some resistance. While the masses expressed interest and even excitement, most of the masses, not all of them, the message of "We are a people" found in their Judenstadt, the Jewish state, resonated with the Jews of Eastern Europe, victims of much messianic disenchantment. Now, here I use the word messianic again in the sense of, you know, they had expected the Messiah. Remember in, I think, two or three lessons ago, we talked about the false Messiah, Shabbatai Zvi, who came in Eastern Europe, and he claimed to be the Messiah. He had quite a following, and then he went to a country it was led by Muslims, and then when the leader of the country told him that if he did not convert to Islam, he would kill him on the spot, Shabbatai Zvi, the Messianic Jewish king, converted to Islam. Shabbatai Zvi. It's in one of your notes. I mean, so you'd probably find it. S-H-A... Okay. Okay. I was saying the Jewish people, when Herzl is coming onto the scene here and saying we need a place of our own, and they convene the first Zionist Congress, okay, in Basel, Switzerland, there was a split. Not everybody agreed with him. But for the most part, many of the people, not the leaders so much, but many of the people said, you know what? We don't really like our life. If anything's going to be better, I mean, where do I sign? Okay, not the very religious ones, but many of those who thought that the Enlightenment and the Haskalah and the Emancipation would work for them and didn't work so well in light of what was happening to Dreyfus at the same time. They said, you know what, that plus the fact that we've had several false messiah come and go, we're ready for like something new, something better. And I was quoting... I was citing the name of this man who I don't remember the date. I want to say it in the 16 or 1700, Shabbatai Zvi, S-H-A-B-B-E-T-A-I, and they spell it differently, Z-V-I. Shabbatai Zvi, he self-proclaimed Messiah of the Jewish people. Jewish people basically... You know, like in the Fiddler on the Roof, you know, when the rabbi looks at his people in the village in a little shtetl, and he goes, now would be a good time for the Messiah to come. So Jewish people are thinking, you know what, any day now, it would be a good time for the Messiah to come. So when Shabbatai Zvi came and he proclaimed he was the Messiah, they said, you know what, not all of them, but many of them said, I could live with that. We could use a Messiah right now to save us, to establish the kingdom and peace in the world. So they followed him, and then he had maybe a little bit of delusion of grandeur, and he went, I forgot what country he went. I think maybe it's Turkey? It's in your notes. Yeah, soon I forget. I teach the class. But it's in your notes, about two or three lessons prior to this one. He started to argue with the leader of the country to say that he was going to take over. He was going to be the new leader. And West Turkey? Okay, West Turkey. And then the leader said, oh, no, you're not. We're Muslims, and if you don't convert to Islam, we're going to kill you. And Shabbatai Zvi, the messianic leader, the king, Messiah, said, okay, where do I sign? And he became a Muslim. To this day, there is a small group of people that still believe and follow his teaching, and they're called Sabbateans. S-A-B-B-A-T-I-A-N. So weird. You don't need to know that, but it's in the notes. The Jewish people go through all that and go like, you know what? Tell us, what's your plan, Herzl? Talk to us, okay? We're interested. You know, not everybody, but for the most part, he's got an audience. He's got an audience. So that's the first Zionist Congress in Basel, Switzerland, 1897. Unfortunately, to have the people behind him, it's good, but he also has to garner the agreement of some of the key world leaders of the time. So the first World Congress, Zionist World Congress, that's on the next page. Herzl and the delegates adopted the Basel program and declared that Zionism aims at establishing for the Jewish people a publicly and legally assured home in Palestine. For the attainment of this purpose, the Congress considers the following means serviceable: the promotion of the settlement of Jewish agriculturists, artisans, and tradesmen in Palestine, the federation of all Jews into local or general groups according to the laws of the various countries, the strengthening of the Jewish feeling and consciousness, preparatory steps for the attainment of those governmental grants which are necessary to the achievement of the Zionist purpose. All they're doing here is they're establishing a little bit of a charter, so to speak. You know, this is what we're all about. This is what we're going to try to do. And so they wrote this this Zionist program. You know, it's bigger than that, but this is the summary of it. Herzl was elected president of the first Jewish Congress in 1897, would convene six more yearly events until 1902. Eventually, the Congress location was moved to Jerusalem in 1936. Lobbying for the homeland. Herzl started lobbying for the Jewish people. He had to, you know, go and speak to the world leaders that could actually help him with this. So he started lobbying for the Jewish people's return to the safe land of their own. He first met with German Kaiser Wilhelm II in Istanbul, in 1898, in an effort to convince him to help secure land in Israel. And he wasn't taken very seriously, and the Kaiser, influenced by his own anti-Semitic tendencies, flatly rejected Herzl's appeals for a Jewish homeland. So that didn't work very well. Well, forget the Germans, let's go see if the Brits can help. Disappointed and frustrated, but not discouraged. And that's one thing about Herzl. He did not get discouraged very easily because what he had to go through, let me tell you. Herzl met with British Colonial Secretary Joseph Chamberlain, who, as a compromise, offered the Jews the country of Uganda. Hey, why not? You know, we could take Uganda. We don't need it. In Eastern Africa. Eventually, in 1903, during the Sixth Zionist Congress, and by now rather discouraged, not completely discouraged, just rather discouraged, Herzl proposed a move of the Jewish people to Uganda. He actually, at the Congress, he said, okay, hear me out. We have a proposition to make. This is what we could do. And they almost tar and feathered him when he said that. He proposed this as a temporary solution until Palestine could be secured as the final homeland for the Jewish people. People reacted immediately, and at the sight of a possible split, that's the last thing they need, is a split within the Zionist movement. There was already a split within the Jewish people, the Zionists, and those who just didn't want to make waves and kind of stay put. So now if we have the Zionist movement that's moving towards a homeland establishment, we got to be together. Otherwise, if we fight within our own ranks, we're not going to go anywhere, which is true. What? he didn't die very old. He died a year later in Vienna at age 44, having spent most of his life, adult life, fighting for Jewish homeland. I don't know what he died of. I forgot. I must have read it in passing, but, you know, age 44, what? Shock? Yeah. So basically the people reacted to the idea of Uganda, and Herzl decided against the compromise. But in Vienna, 1897, he said, that's when he said almost prophetically, at Basel, I created the Jewish state. In 5 years, perhaps, and certainly in 50, everyone will see it. 1947 is 50 years later. I think it's kind of cool. So, did that, you know, he died, and then what happened? Well, Zionism after Theodor Herzl. He was just the beginning. One could argue that during Herzl's life, Zionism was mainly a political movement relying on diplomacy for any sustainable existence. But even Herzl saw that political Zionism and practical Zionism, while having the same goal, had different methods. The chasm would divide further as the Jewish homeland became more of a reality. Herzl had worked hard at gathering funds, yet they hadn't been dispersed significantly, and a move from the theoretical to the practical was necessary. So he was I don't want to call him a theoretical Zionist, but he got people organized. He got them going into the right direction. He tried to get people involved in making decisions, but it would have been nice for him to live another 10 or 15 years to see what happened, after he died, because much more happened. He was a great contributor to Zionism, but much more happened after he died. Additionally, there was a serious push for a Hebrew Renaissance as well. The idea of cultural Zionism, mostly introduced by Russian Jews, appealed to a wider spectrum within the Jewish community. While political Zionism left many of the more religious leaders unsatisfied and unable to relate to the cause. So you have a political Zionism that really the religious Jewish people were like, not my thing, okay? I'm not interested. Now you've got also a more cultural aspect to Zionism, and that's attracting more of the religious Jewish people. So now we've got a broader interest within the Jewish community. A key player who had not always seen eye to eye with Herzl was Russian Jewish essayist Asher Ginzburg, who went by the pen name Ahad Aham, Hebrew for one of the people. Aham is known as the father of cultural Zionism, and his vision was a Jewish state and not merely a state of Jews. He felt that Jewish people should return gradually to Palestine, while diaspora Jews should be given a vision of the new homeland, making them jealous and thus drawing them to a move. Another important figure in the fight for cultural rebirth was Hebrew lexicographer Eliezer ben Yehuda, who immigrated to Israel during the first Aliyah of 1881. And I put a little note on the bottom of the page of the Aliyahs. It means the ascent, and they're like the mass exodus of Jewish people. There's a couple of main ones in late 1800 and early 1900 of Jewish people. So he immigrated to Israel in 1881, dedicated the rest of his life, not without tremendous hardship, to the rebirth of Hebrew as a modern tongue. There's a great book that was written on him called The Tongue of the Prophets by Robert St. John, and it was a biography, and in the book, St. John says, in 20 years, he had fathered 10 children. 5 had died, but 5 still lived. 2 of them spoke fluently the language he had spent so much of these 20 years trying to bring back to life. More important, the streets of Jerusalem, the marketplaces, the villages scattered over the desert were thronged with other Jews who spoke the same revived language. This was a miracle. And ancient Hebrew, ancient biblical Hebrew was reborn before the country was reborn as a nation, as a language. There's a story in the book where one of Ben Yehuda's son or kids, comes home, and he's like, he's not looking too good. He got in a fight with some kids at school, and then and his father goes like, "What happened?" He said, "Well, I got in trouble at school with the kids, and they called me names," and he's got a big smile, and he goes, "They called me names," and his father goes, "Well, that's not good," and I forgot exactly the premise, but it's, I don't know if he says exactly that, but he says something to the effect of, "Why are you smiling?" And he goes, "Because they cursed me in Hebrew," and it was like a big, it was a big accomplishment, okay, because you think about a language that was non-existent, it was only existing in the prayer books and in the scriptures themselves. That said, it was not a language used for anything but prayers and reading of the Tanakh, of the Jewish scriptures. And he said, "We are going to make this our language." And he had to invent a lot of words. And they keep inventing them. Not many now, but I mean, words like, ironing board, airplane, all those words don't exist, so they had to be invented. But the base for modern Hebrew is ancient Hebrew that was revived, and you can see the hand of God in that, because it's just an amazing story. You read the book?
No.
Sorry? The book is, it's on the last page, it's by Robert St. John, and it's called Tongue of the Prophets. They might have it, I think they have it in the library here, you can borrow it. So in the decade following Herzl's death, Zionist influx continued in the Holy Land, and about 100,000 pioneers lived there. Times were hard, work days were long, poverty was rampant, but the spirit of hope kept Zionism alive, not to mention God himself, of course. You know, God is really working behind the scene. But we have a people that is looking at a country, and when you look at what happened with Israel, how the birth of Zionism, helped. You know, God is behind the scene, but the people are helping make Israel what it is today. It's quite a miracle. On the eve of World War I, Zionism has become a reality, a fragile one, but a reality nonetheless. Now, much more is going to happen. Now, of course, the reason why I'm going to spend a little more time describing Zionism and telling you who the key players were and what they did and why not, is because today there is an agenda by people that know nothing about Zionism. They don't care about how it came about. They don't care why it came about. They don't care who was behind it. And they just want to use the word and equate the word with Jewish hegemony or Jewish takeover of the land of Palestine that does not belong to them. So to them, Zionism is the epitome of modern racism. That's what they say. So this is nonsense. So we have to really understand what Zionism is all about if people are going to tell us, well, you know, the Zionists, you know, they're just anti-Palestinians. Wait a minute. Explain what a Zionist is. You know, when you know about something and you ask people to explain it to you and they don't have a clue, the conversation stops right there. So you know what? Until you can explain to me what you mean by the word, then I'm not interested in discussing it, okay? We might not agree, but at least we have to know the meaning behind the words that we share in conversation. And too often, especially in the case of Zionism, equals racism, there's no sense at all. That makes no sense at all. So, well, that's we're at the end of the note. So, we're done for